You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 110. Now, folks, the following was, I had my conversation with Aaron about 4 or 5 days ago, and we were worried that by this time, everything that we said would be outdated. And fortunately, everything is good. I am still here in my apartment, still healthy. Obviously, there have been more closings and more progression of the pandemic, but so far nothing unusual has happened for the last 5 days, I think. So I think this is still relevant, so we're good to go.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome to another episode of The Local Maximum, episode 110. That means that we are in another decade in terms of Local Maximum speak, another 10 episodes. I wonder what the 110s are going to be about, Aaron. What do you think?
I don't think anything interesting has been going on globally.
I hope that we are not talking about the pandemic by the time it comes to episode 120. But we'll see. That's my hope at this point. So, yeah, I'm taking this with stride, but I have to report that I am currently somewhat self-quarantined in my apartment for the next 8 days. So I'm looking around at the room I'm in. I better be pretty happy with this room. You know, maybe I better clean it up or something like that. I guess the good news is nothing will be stopping me from producing podcasts. And the reason is, but I'm not doing this just for fun. I apparently was in contact with someone who has the coronavirus. And so we'll see what happens. We're going to actually pour through some of the data later in the show today to see, you know, what the chances that I'll get it are. And so some of that data actually looks pretty good for me. Although, unless, of course, everything else going on outside here gets much worse over the next 10 days. So we'll see what happens. But we'll go through that. So today we're going to look. We're going to do exactly what I said I wasn't going to do in the last episode, which was try to report information on the coronavirus outbreak. And by the way, this is not coming out for 4 days, so who knows? I might have to put an addendum at the beginning of this episode to tell you what's changed in the last 4 days. If there's no addendum, then it means probably there are more cases and more shutdowns and stuff, but like nothing major off trajectory.
I think so, it would be grossly optimistic of us to assume that between now when we're recording and when this episode releases, that there will be a major breakthrough and things will be on the upswing in terms of improvement. I think things are going to get worse before they get better.
Well, thank you for that, Aaron. Nice.
You're welcome.
And upbeat as normal. I think we'll get through this. I mean, I know people are acting like it's like the plague from either the medieval times or from the Book of Exodus or something like that. I think we're going to get through it. I think everything just shut down really fast. So there's the question of whether it wasn't fast enough or whether it was too fast. But anyway, one of the things that I think is driving us crazy is there's so much information and misinformation flying around, particularly on Twitter, all over the internet, a lot of the articles coming out from the news. Just a comparison that I have in my mind. I mean, I remember, you know, on 9/11 when people warned, actually teachers in the school that I was in warned me that, you know, hey, you know, be careful with the news today. You know, journalists might, might exaggerate things. They might not give you the right information right away. And then it turned out on 9/11, they actually did surprisingly well, at least when you compare it to today.
Well, do you feel the same way? In terms of what criteria?
In terms of reporting on what was going on as the information came in and as it unfolded, and sort of stepping back from their politicization of everything and sort of stepping back from, it was hard not to be... you know, there was a little worst case scenarioing on 9/11, which is hard to think, hey, it's 9/11. How could you how could there be someone who says there's going to be an even worse case scenario? But there were definitely people saying like, oh, you know, 10 planes have been hijacked and they're hitting all these cities. And I don't know if you remember that. And,
I don't remember that specifically, but there was,
yeah,
there was not a compelling case to be made that, you know, well, first of all, when the first tower was hit, I don't think anyone was predicting that another plane was going to intentionally crash into something. So they missed the boat on that because it did get worse. But I don't think there was any compelling argument once the second tower had been hit to say that, you know, there aren't more cases, that there's not going to be more organized attacks of some sort in the next minutes, hours, days, or weeks. You know, in hindsight, we know now that there really wasn't anything in the works, but it would have been foolish to have said, oh, it's done. This is as bad as it can get. Now we can focus on the recovery.
Yeah, but it's another difference is, you know, I feel like every month for the last 10 years has been X is going to kill us all. And it's they've just been going over it again and again. Actually, this led to the have you seen the Babylon Bee, the explicitly fake news site? I should get in. I now I have to go to them because I forget what the exact headline was.
I'm familiar with the Bee, but I haven't seen any of their coronavirus coverage. Oh, well.
The headline was something like, you know, media that's been telling you everything is going to destroy you for the last 10 years is very upset that people aren't listening to them on coronavirus. But it does hit home because, I mean, it's hard. I feel like it's harder to take the news as seriously as you did, especially when it contradicts itself so much. I mean, that could partially be a function of having so many different sources of information now.
Yeah, I think the baseline approach is much more, well, it still existed back in was it 2001, but
sure.
The prevalence of news commentary over news reporting has become much more dramatic, and the ability to couch everything in terms of team sports such that, you know, this is, you know, either Trump is making it worse by doing X, or, you know, the Democrats in the House are not doing enough on Y. It's not particularly productive, but everyone wants to score points somehow. So,
no, I read those things. I hate to say it, but I read those things, and I feel like those articles had already been written. It's like all these articles had been in there. Metaphysical drawers, just been writing to fill in the names and the dates and whatever as appropriate and put out there now as I read the news. And it's a terrible way to read the news, but that's sort of how I feel. So I guess we,
thankfully,
like everybody else.
At least as far as I can tell, this continues to be the case. There are some resources which are remaining apolitical and can be considered highly trustworthy, starting first with the CDC, then the WHO, and I think Johns Hopkins is being considered kind of one of the go-to resources of the Johns Hopkins Medical School or the School of Public Health for their data collection and reporting on this. That if you want, you know, just the facts, please, those are excellent places to go. But once you step beyond those hard resources and start looking at network news, you might get some of that, but you're going to get it with a spoonful of whatever the commentary du jour is.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen Twitter conversations where someone on Twitter, and you're not on Twitter, so maybe maybe you're just lucky, but there'll be people who...
Do you think Twitter use is correlated to susceptibility?
I don't know. So I saw this, and I think I saw it more than one time, but I saw someone saying, well, you're an idiot for saying that. It's actually the opposite of that. And the reason why you're an idiot is because you don't understand math. And here's a link with the math. And you go to the link, and it's like so complex and there's all these charts and graphs and numbers, and even I'm like, dude, you didn't even read that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and so I'm all for math and logic when it proves the point, but I'm against it when you use it to bludgeon someone else with, because you're like, math and logic and science say this, but then you're just using it as a bludgeon, but you're not actually explaining the math and logic and science.
And I'm sure I've been guilty of that myself in the past, that the reason you share a link is not because it's something interesting that you read. It's because you read the headline and you think that it will prove your point and make you look superior to the person you're sharing it with. Or sharing it about.
Yes.
Which is an unfortunate symptom of our times. But yeah, it's certainly got out of hand. And you see it on both ends of the spectrum. People who are saying, you know, we're all going to die. This is the end times. And people saying that, you know, there's nothing to worry about. This is literally a government conspiracy to scare us into our homes.
Look,
y'all are both wrong.
Yeah. Before we go on,
there's an inability
to
handle nuance and accept that maybe something isn't completely one side or the other, that there's a middle ground for where reality resides.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So where do you want to start today? We have a few other links here. Do you want to start by talking with the Johns Hopkins study, which obviously I was looking at very closely for very self-interested reasons? Or
yeah, I think let's dive into that, because there's some I don't know if we can strictly call it a Bayesian analysis to go along with that, but certainly
it's
some
probabilistic.
Yeah. And it has real world implications that are striking close to home, which is, you know, very much what we set out to do from the very beginning on the show.
Yeah. Okay. So right. So this is important to me because I apparently had come in contact with someone who has the virus on Thursday. So that would be 1 week before. 7 days before today, before we record this.
recording now on the 12th. Yes,
unless I include an addendum at the beginning, I have not shown symptoms yet. But as of today, I have not shown symptoms. And so the question is, how likely is it that I will show symptoms? And I, you know, obviously I want to know that. And, you know, of course I've been out in the city since then too. So now I'm worried, like, I could also get it from someone just in the subway. Apparently it looks like it's very unlikely. You could catch it from just walking down the street even from a restaurant.
You have
like
a known exposure window, but that is not necessarily your only exposure opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, Johns Hopkins did this study. They looked at some publicly available data. And so we could talk about what those biases might be. But they looked at some publicly available data for people who have the virus, where we know when they contacted it. They know when they were exposed to it. And then we also know when they started to show symptoms. And they built a little probability distribution around that. And so what the probability distribution looks like is the support of the probability distribution. When we say the support, that is like what are the ranges of values that we're talking about. So, for example, the support of a coin flip is heads and tails. That's like the set of all events. In this case, the set of all events is all positive numbers, which is the number of days or the amount of time since exposure. And what they found was, so they built a little probability distribution around that, and they gave out two numbers. They can't just publish the probability distribution. People don't understand that. That's something I have to live with at work and things like that. People don't like, you have to have the whole probability distribution, but people don't like to get it. So you have to break it down into a couple numbers. So they said there's a 5.1 median days to show symptoms. And they said that there is, after 11.5 days, 97% of people show symptoms. So that's what it is. And so they fit a curve to all the points they have, because they only had 200 data points. essentially there's a discussion on which probability distribution they picked. It's a very technical discussion, but I'm kind of real nerdy on those things, so I have to look into it. One is the log normal distribution. So most people, I think, are familiar with the normal distribution. That's the standard bell curve. It's got a mean. It's got a standard deviation. You know, it's kind of symmetrical, right? So that means that, hey, if it were a normal distribution, that would mean that, you know, if it's if you have a certain probability of 10 days, then your probability of 9 days and 11 days are going to be the same because it's symmetrical. Now, this is definitely not a normal distribution. And the reason is that the support of a normal distribution is all real numbers go negative, it could go positive. And so when you're dealing with a positive number, it's usually one of those positive number distributions. There are a few of them. They chose to use the log normal, but they also, which I like to see, they also tried to fit it to many other positive distributions. One is the gamma distribution that you use a lot in Bayesian inference that I like, and they checked to make sure that all of them give similar answers, which I really liked. Okay, so that that opens up some questions to me, like as far as I can tell, and I don't know if you saw this, Aaron, there were no correlations between, we know that there are correlations between how deadly this virus is and how, you know, how prevalent it is in different ages and people with different pre-existing conditions, and to some extent gender, I think, a little bit too. I think I saw that. I don't know which gender gets it worse, but I think I saw that there's a small effect there. So I don't know if the days to show symptoms is also affected by these things, but yeah, maybe we can assume that they are.
On the gender topic, and my data on this is a couple days old, but I had heard that it is infecting at roughly a 50% equal split between genders. However, among those infected, there's a higher fatality rate for males.
Okay.
Which I heard from another source.
But it's not as stark as the age difference,
no,
of course.
No. Interestingly enough, I think another doctor I heard interviewed was saying that that's not terribly surprising because the standard influenza also has a slightly higher fatality rate for males, that it probably has something to do with hormone levels and how that interacts with the virus. But yeah, it looks like the split on the data here was not 50-50. It was about 60-40 male to female, and there was a median age of 44.5 years for this particular paper we were looking at.
Okay, so that's interesting. So that's that goes right back to my last episode with Adam Kapellner. I don't know if you listened to that one yet.
Yes.
But yeah, so I mean, every time I have someone on, they're directly useful to what's going on in the next episode, but I am totally not planning it. It just happens to work because we have very good instincts.
Maybe we need to be more
maximum.
Careful about who you interview since there's clearly correlation. There might be some causation there.
Oh, you mean like it affects the world events? Yeah, maybe that's true. Okay, so... And it's funny because I had him on my interview list for 2 years. So, and the fact that this is coming up now is like the splits between people in experiments. Of course, this is observational data, but still. Okay, but the question I was asking was a little different. Was, okay, is this distribution going to be very different for men or women or for people of different ages? And that I don't think the paper says anything about.
And I would be somewhat suspect of anything they did say on that, given the small sample size of 181 cases, that if you start breaking your data set down into smaller and smaller groups like that, it's a lot harder to extract meaningful trends there.
I assume it wasn't stark. Okay, so if it's 5.1 median days to show symptoms and it's already 7, that means that I'm probably, I don't know, around 70. I can calculate that with a log normal distribution, but I haven't done it yet. I can do it in Python. But I probably, let me guess in my head, maybe around 70% of the of the time is up. I'm over the hump for 70%.
I'm looking at figure one here, or excuse me, figure two, and just eyeballing it, that sounds about right.
Okay, okay, good. And each day it gets a little better. Now, the second thing is, I know other people who were exposed in a similar way that I was around the same time, and in other words, we're all in the same room, and those people have not shown symptoms either. And so the question is, if it were something where it's like, what do I want to say? If it's kind of randomly chosen from the distribution, if there's no correlations there, and everybody in the room didn't get it after 7 days, that could probably mean that no one in the room is going to get it. Like, it's very unlikely that there was any transfer there. Or we were in like a different part of the room or something, because everyone in my part of the room was safe. So I don't know. That's hopeful, unless there's some weird correlation there that I'm not thinking of. I think the data on that looks good for me personally. Now, enough about me personally. Like, let's talk about everybody else, because I think, everything's being shut down. You and I were looking at the numbers state by state, country to country, and as people have pointed out, if that was just some random affliction and you didn't know what it was, those numbers wouldn't be too alarming. Of course, the trouble is, like, you know, the exponential growth, and it's very unclear. A lot of people are extrapolating the exponential growth out as far as they'd like. We know that these types of exponential curves don't go on forever. And so we don't know exactly where it ends up. Beware of someone who doesn't extrapolate the exponential growth at all, and beware of someone who extrapolates it as far as they want to make their point as well, I would say.
Yeah, there's always the danger of allowing your biases to creep in, even unintentionally.
Right. Okay, so a question that I was asking is, what's the maximum number of people in a country that could be infected? Because in Germany, they said, 70% of the country are eventually going to be infected. And for what it's worth, again, I don't know how to generalize this, but I think it might be important, is we were looking at Diamond Princess. And you pointed out something interesting, because that was on a list of countries, right?
Yeah, they were the 10th largest, or the... In the list of countries with the most infections, they were ranked number 10. I think it was
so it's
ahead
a cruise
of Switzerland.
Ship, but it was considered a country for these purposes. Okay. And so the ship, it looked like under 20% of the ship actually got it, even though they were clearly all exposed.
And now, are we presuming that everyone on that ship was tested, or did they only test those showing symptoms? Is it possible that there could be carriers who were exposed and caught the virus but were completely asymptomatic?
I
don't know what the testing protocol was for the Diamond Princess. I know in the U.S. There appears to be limits on the available tests, and so they're reserving test kits for those cases that are not just showing symptoms but have known opportunities for exposure, or at least they were until very recently. That's something
people
that
being
very hopefully will have changed by the time this episode airs.
Right. I'm sure that maybe not everyone on the ship will be tested, but I'm sure a lot of people will be when they come onto shore. And so if it's literally the fact that like 100% of people on that boat have test positive, I think we'd hear about it.
Right.
So right now, let's say it's 20%. I mean, maybe 80% of people just don't get it, which is possible.
And raises some very interesting questions for where their resistance or immunity might be coming from in terms of coming up with a vaccine.
Right. I mean, look, I think with all of these things, you know, whenever there's a bug going around, there's always a few people that just don't get it. Even if everybody around them is sick. There's sometimes like everyone in the family gets a bug, and then sometimes like one person is spared, surprisingly. I don't know if you've experienced that, but
absolutely. And I couldn't tell you in that case whether it's a matter of having immunity or being a carrier or some combination of other factors there. But from an outside perspective, without additional data, that's all going to look the same.
Right. Right. Okay. So this is kind of related to people. There is a lot of controversy over the death rate of COVID-19. From what I read, the flu has a death rate of 0.1%. Of course, that's also going to be very different depending on age and pre-existing condition, I would assume.
Right. And there are many strains of flu, so I assume that that's kind of an averaging of overall influenza statistics.
Spanish flu was really bad. That was the 1918 epidemic. Did you know, unlike the coronavirus, which is also called the Wuhan virus, it's named after the place it started. The Spanish flu, I should probably confirm this, but I was reading it did not originate in Spain.
No, it originated, I want to say in was it Oklahoma or maybe Nebraska?
Oh, really? It was here in the U.S.
I think so.
So I think the reason that it was called the Spanish flu is because the Spanish government was collecting all the data because it was right. I don't. Was it during World War One or was it after? Or was it?
It was during the tail end of World War One. Yeah.
Right. So you couldn't have data being like, you know, Spain was a neutral country, so they were able to gather the data from everyone. Is what happened, I think. I have to look into that. But so great, they have a virus named after them, even though it didn't originate in their country. Okay, so right, so the death rate for corona, death rate sounds so harsh. I should say fatality rate, or should I just say death rate and get it over with?
We all know what we're talking about.
Yeah, okay. The numbers that I've seen given are between 3% and 0.3%. Well, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself because that's just off the top of my head. But you've probably seen numbers similar where it's like the low single digits in terms of percentage. And then there's also it's also possible that it's a fraction of a percent, right?
Yeah. I've heard everything ranging from as you said, single digits, like 3 or 4%, down to 0.3%, or I think it was 0.6.
Yes. So you could contact the experts, instead of us, but if you contact the experts will give you lots of different answers and they'll all be within that range.
Yeah. Because this is, it's a moving target. Because we only have data on those who've been tested, and there's an obvious selection bias in those who've been tested. That those of you likely to have the virus are much more likely to go and get tested.
Right, right. So here's what someone asked on Twitter. Someone asked me, how can you estimate the true fatality rate if you're only testing people with severe symptoms? And actually, I thought about that problem for a little bit, and it's actually similar to some of the problems that I've worked on the past when it even comes to like marketing data and things like that. The robot in my phone turned on. It thinks I said Cortana, but anyway. All right. So it's not my phone, in my headphones. Have these new Microsoft headphones. They're wireless. They're very nice noise canceling, but I don't know.
You need to get Bill Gates exercised from your headphones.
Yeah. Okay, so where was I? Oh, right. I was saying that this problem is similar to some of the problems that I've dealt with in terms of user-generated data and marketing data in the past at Foursquare and problems that I've solved before. So I want to talk a little bit about that. How would I approach it? Because here's where a Bayesian model would really shine. So first thing you need in a Bayesian model is what's your hypothesis space, right? And so we're trying to figure out what the fatality rate is, right? And so the hypothesis space is a number between 0 and 1, right? Yep. 0 and 100%. So that's pretty simple. If you want to make your model a little more complicated in like the second or third round of this, you would actually have a global death rate, but then you'd have a positive multiplier for each. You'd have like a little multiplier for each age range and each gender and perhaps adding some other health data. So like, oh, does the person smoke? Does the person have XYZ? Then maybe that you have like a little bit that gets added to their probability. And by added, I mean you would probably use odds instead of probability maybe and multiply the odds. That's why it's a positive number by a positive number. But I'm not going to get into that. Yeah, it's that's all complicated. So if you make the math work.
You would take an actuarial approach that rarely are they going to base your insurance, you know, life insurance policy on, you know, what year were you born? What is the life expectancy? Okay, there's your rate. They're going to want to know your gender, where you live, what your education is, you know, whether you're a smoker, because all of those are going to modify that probability and place you on a different place on that distribution.
Right, right. So now the hypothesis space gets much more complicated. So let's say we have four age ranges, okay? So now we need four fatality rates instead of one fatality rate. So instead of number between 0 and 1, it's four numbers between 0 and 1, and now all of a sudden it's a four-dimensional space, right? So it does get a lot more complicated. So one thing that I would do is I would have a global rate, and then I would have a difference off that global rate. And the reason for that, maybe I would do two rates for the ages because it's so stark. But the reason for that is for gender, I would definitely do it this way, where I'd have one global rate, and then I'd have a little wiggle room for if you're male, a little wiggle room if you're female to go up and down. The reason is because the global rate could be anything, but my prior for the wiggle room, the extra points, if you're male or female, the prior would be very thin. I would expect that to be a very low number. And so that we can like estimate, that we don't really need to estimate very much.
Whereas age is going to have a larger spread there.
Yeah, that's why I said age. I might just straight up partition the data, frankly, because it looks like it's such a difference. But okay, so let's assume that we just have. Let's try to focus on the problem at hand,
yep,
which is trying to get the global rate. And so let's say that these confounders are not an issue, or we dealt with them in some other way. So okay, we're looking for a number between 0 and 1. We come up with a prior on that number, a prior distribution. It probably won't matter that much because the data is going to give us the answer. But I think with the prior, we can kind of look at other similar known diseases and construct a distribution. You know, what Ebola is 80%, certain cancers are like 80, 90, 95%. So there's some in that range. Most diseases that are of this type are in the lower range. As in low, you know, low as in under 50%. But, you know, I would assume that the prior doesn't, you're not going to use a uniform prior. You're probably going to use something that's weighted to the, you know, 0 to 10% or what you would expect. But you would use something that's kind of open to everything, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the data is data on who got the virus and who recovered. And who, and the fatalities and when, right? And so the thing that you have to understand, if this were just randomized from the global population, then you could plug that right into your Bayesian model. That's like a randomized controlled experiment, effectively, and then you would have your answer. But because it's not, you do have to assume that it came from a distribution within the global population. And so the assumption is that, you know, the percentage of people who were infected got very bad symptoms, which is also correlated with, which is also going to be correlated with their fatality rate. And is all their symptoms are correlated with both their fatality rate and it's correlated with their propensity to get the test, right? Those two things are affected by the symptoms, and the symptoms are affected by whether you are infected or not. Because you could have those symptoms if you're not infected, right, as well. So that has to be taken care of. So now we have several Bayesian models, and so now you actually have what's called a Bayesian network. And that I talked a little bit about with Sophie Carr in episode 105 And so now you form Vasey Mesery is also it's also related to causality theory, because you know what the causal links are in each piece of this. And so that's I talked about that in episode 31 as well. All these things are relevant. So and that's, of course, Judea Pearl seems to be the guy to go to talk about causality models nowadays. Maybe I'll try to get him on the program. So now you have several different Bayesian models that you want to kind of put together and calculate. But I'm not going to, like, that can be done. So the interesting thing is, okay, if nobody is being tested who has no symptoms, then what do you do? And I don't think that it's literally nobody is being tested who has no symptoms. I feel like there has to be some data on some people with no symptoms who have been tested. It might, if not, if there's not enough, it might be helpful to randomly test a few people to see what's going on, right? Because if you test 10 random people and none of them have it, that significantly, in a certain geography, that significantly lowers your estimate for how many people are infected.
Right. Well, so we're looking at the fatality rate among those infected, not at the infection rate among those exposed here. So,
right. But you need to know both.
Right. We need to basically eliminate from the possible denominator of those exposed, from the denominator of those infected, we need to eliminate those who are either not exposed or have been exposed but are not infected. We're just interested in those infected who dies.
Yeah. And those people, so you could have of the people who were exposed and infected but showed no symptoms or no strong symptoms, you basically have to estimate what the percentage of those are. And so that is a Bayesian model in and of itself. You would have some prior over it. And you actually do get data on that coming in, because, you know, I would say that some of the effects of the Diamond Princess might be data. There are cases where people who don't have symptoms have been tested. That's been going on in South Korea. And so you can kind of use that data to estimate that better and better. And so maybe we don't have a great estimate of it right now, but I think that the data is out there to make that estimate. So that's just how I'd approach it. There's a few things that I would compare this to things that I had worked on in the past. One certainly is ad attribution, where, companies would expose someone to an ad, which is similar to exposing someone to a virus, I guess you could say. And then the person would go to the place that the company wanted them to go to buy stuff. I guess that's equivalent to testing positive.
But did they then actually buy something or not?
Yeah, we don't know if they bought something or not. We don't know if the model is perfect. And also, another thing that I did was we actually had such a huge data set that we removed a lot of the non-visits from that data set because it was just so huge. And because we knew what was going on, we can kind of recombine that to get a sense of what was going on with the data we had. This is kind of a complicated issue. It's kind of tough to explain, but yes, there are ways to estimate this, which is, I think, the bottom line. There are statistical ways to do it, and it kind of matches up with common sense, which is that all these things are estimable, if that makes sense. And that's why North Korea is a whole other issue, where they say they have no cases and nobody believes them. South Korea is testing lots and lots of people, and their fatality rate is significantly lower, which kind of tells us that they're closer to the true fatality rate.
Right. And I mean, there are many things that affect the fatality. Well, I guess effects on fatality rate, they might have an upper hand there in that I expect South Korea has a fairly strong medical infrastructure. And so they might be able to provide more support to those who do have severe symptoms. But what I was about to comment on and would have been a leap in the wrong direction is They may also have a lower rate of transmission in South Korea, but that's a different issue than the fatality rate, and that may be because of social distancing and some cultural stuff, and the fact that they've had, you know, a heads up in that they got to see some of it unfold in China before it hit them, and so they can avoid getting caught off guard and making some of the mistakes that were made before we knew what we were dealing with here.
Yeah. There are a lot of people screaming right now that we are screwing it up in the U.S. I feel like there's nothing I could do about it if we are right now. But we don't know how things are going to turn out. We have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, and there has to be a cost-benefit analysis as well, both on the national, the state, local, and the individual level, in that absolutely there are things that can be done to minimize your risk. If you lock yourself in your bunker and you don't come out for a few months, the chances of you catching this disease are dramatically decreased.
I'm not worried about people.
Is the risk, you know, like high enough that it would justify making that life choice? And for some people, they've already made that life choice without the presence of the coronavirus. They'd much prefer to live in solitary isolation. So for them, it's no big deal. It's an excuse that nobody's going to come bother me now because everybody else should be doing the same thing.
How many people do you think are saying, "Oh, I have the coronavirus," just to get out of events or make sure someone doesn't come over?
I'm sure there are some. I think. Well, yeah, I don't know how many people would have preferred to have this kind of excuse all along, but we're too afraid to just come out and say they don't want to do X, Y, or Z. There are some, I'm sure, who are leveraging that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think the scary thing is being here in New York City when we are around people so much, especially on the subway, on the elevators, on the street. I am not too concerned walking down the street, but who knows? Maybe I should be. I think I probably shouldn't be, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, and it is my hope that one of the things that comes out of this is a generational reinvigoration of good hygiene habits, that people who've lived through, you know, coronavirus 2020 will hopefully for the rest of their lives be more conscious about hand washing, not sneezing and coughing on people, and
People have gotten worse at that over the last 10 years, haven't they?
Well, yeah, 10, I mean, people years. In general are disgusting, but there's some fairly low impact things you can do that dramatically reduce your risk here. And just because, say in 18 to 36 months, we have a vaccine for coronavirus, doesn't mean you should stop doing all those things, because the benefits ripple out through pretty much everything in your life. If you can reduce your chance of catching seasonal flu by 50%, it's probably worth washing your hands twice as many times a day.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. All right, so I hate to sort of think like what we're missing in 4 days when this goes out. I think it's safe to assume, well, there'll be some more closures.
Yeah, well, for perspective, I think your work advised or required work from home several days ago. Has it been a week already?
Mm-hmm.
And my work announced this afternoon that they're recommending that the folks in my office work from home for the foreseeable future. I would not be surprised if we see much larger steps along those lines, with state and local governments taking more direction on that. I guess Massachusetts, the governor has already said, if you can work from home, do. But that's very much this is a good idea, not like in that one snowstorm we had a few years back, where they literally said, we're closing the roads to non-emergency personnel. If you are out on the road and you are not an emergency person, we will be arresting you and sending you home. So they're not arresting people for going into their offices anytime soon, I don't think.
This makes me think, like, what would this have been like if this had happened 20 years ago, when you really couldn't work from home? I remember even when I worked at Wireless Generation, 2006 to 2009, I didn't have a laptop there. I had a desktop there. I wouldn't have been able to work from home.
Yeah, and the idea of being able to be on, I mean, not everybody had, well, I guess most people our generation had cell phones at that point. But we weren't as tied at the hip to them as we are now. I don't think many people would think much of being on, you know, conference calls for several hours of the day on their cell phone now. And I think a lot of people will be doing that in the coming weeks. But in the days of landlines, that would have been ridiculous. That if you were doing that much talking on a landline at home, you had two phone lines because you didn't want to be tying up the only phone.
Yeah, but there wasn't that much work that you could do. You couldn't, your data and like your documents weren't mobile. It's not, you know, there was no Google Docs. I mean, talk about 20 years ago, you know, you wouldn't, what would you do? I mean, unless you had, most people didn't have their work at home.
You would have a courier who would come by in their bicycle or their small vehicle, and they would take your faxes and carry them over to another person's home office.
I'm talking about like 2003 or something. But yeah, no, it's crazy that to think like how different this would have been just a few years ago. So what I was saying before,
that's another interesting thing that could potentially come out of this is we might be telling our children decades from now that, you know, 2020, that was the year that the American economy went, you know, 80% work from home because we did it for 6 months and realized why would we go back to the offices after that? Do you
like working from home?
It has its pluses and minuses. And I'm not making a prediction that is what's going to happen, but I could very well see that being a possible outcome here. That if we've taken all the steps to make it possible, that not everybody's going to go back to the old ways. And I think another place we're going to see that is schools, that a huge number of universities are trying to make the transition to go virtual for the remainder of this semester. And some that's going to be a lot harder than others because they may not have the infrastructure already in place. But once they prove they can do that, how's that going to affect the economic model for universities where they're charging you $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a semester to come there when they've already proven that you can get a roughly equivalent education from your own home?
Yeah, I mean, I liked going, but it might not be worth the cost.
Yeah.
Or it might have been worth. I had some classes that at one class, electronic communities with Kristen Sosulski, who actually I've thought of bringing her on to the Local Maximum. But that was a class that was 50% online, 50% virtual, and 50% in person. And maybe you could do more things like that, where you sort of mix it a little bit, and that way you can sort of do the things in person that are better to do in person.
And this is getting way off topic, and
we've run long enough here. It's a good local.
But I think there's an interesting question about what is the value proposition that you can take online courses and gain the knowledge, but what justifies the difference between that and the high cost of getting the sheepskin, the certificate, and where do we draw that line? It's easy to say that, well, if you aren't on campus having the in-person experience with the other students and the professors and the grad students, that you're missing out on something, and so your experience isn't of the same caliber. But I think we're about to get a live experiment in how much of that can be implemented without the benefit of face-to-face contact.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's interesting to
see how that develops.
Yeah. To be clear, I'm not worried about staying at home. There are people panicking out there. I'm not worried about running out of toilet paper. I'm not worried about running out of food and supplies. I could always have things delivered.
Yeah, well,
that stuff's not going to be shut down.
And thankfully,
and the economy is pretty resilient.
We're not at the point where we're looking at infrastructure shutdown. It's not like a few years ago when there was a gas line explosion in my area, and power was out for several days, and people couldn't go back to their homes. The expectation, at least for now, is that, you know, water, sewer, electricity, heat, all that stuff is going to keep going for folks. We're not looking at an infrastructure collapse yet. Now, if infection rates get up to that predicted, you know, the number that some people have thrown up there of you know over 50%, then you might have trouble staffing all that critical infrastructure, and we could see issues there. But I think we're a long ways from hitting that.
I think that's very unlikely. I think that I think it's almost impossible. I think they would just look. This is not Ebola with an 80% death rate. This is not the bubonic plague. This is not going to come in. And I feel like from the data I've seen, the majority of people recover relatively fast. Now, look, for some people, it's very, very serious. But I think critical infrastructure and also people who have restaurants are going to be very happy to send people out to deliver food.
Yeah, well,
you know, because they're losing business. And
worth keeping in mind, though, is that you don't need to hit that 80%, fatality rate. That it is a surprising small percentage of critical personnel being out of circulation that can cause some tipping points or some domino effects there. I still don't think we're going to hit that, but I'm
not worried about it, Aaron. I really don't want you to give me the worst case scenario here.
Someone was commenting because Iran, I think, was getting hit pretty hard starting a couple of weeks ago, and it looked like it was rampaging through that country. Particularly, I heard somewhere that maybe it was as much as like 10% of their parliament was infected.
How'd that happen? Was it going around parliament so here's another thing. If 108 people in Canada have it and one of them happens to be the prime minister's wife, wow, what a coincidence. There's got to be a lot more people than that.
Possibly. Let me take a step back.
Unless it's going around government because there's so many crowds there.
What I was getting to with Iran and their parliament is there's a theory not necessarily coming from disease epidemiology, but maybe perhaps more from CIA counterinsurgency work, that if you can take 5% of the administrative force of a government out of commission, then the whole institution is at risk of collapse. And so I think there may be some institutions which are going to reach that 5% potential tipping point. And it becomes very easy for things to spiral out of control then, even though 95% of the people don't have, aren't out sick with whatever it is. So
I think that the fact that we're acting now and people are staying home and, the transmission rate is going to go down, I think we're going to be fine on that. Just my prediction, I'm not worried about that stuff happening here. I could be, I'm always worried that could be famous last words, but I'm just not worried about that at all.
And most of us have parents or grandparents who are advanced in age and are in a much more severe risk profile. So even though we may be a little cavalier, and by that I don't mean we're going out and doing stupid things in stupid places with stupid people, but we're not fearing for our lives currently. There are those who legitimately should be very concerned.
Yeah, no, I do know a lot of people who are much older, and I'm very concerned about that. But hopefully we'll stay safe out there, and we'll do what we can. Aaron, I want to give you an exercise before we head out, because you've been given a lot of worst-case scenarios today.
I was going to say, plan for the worst, hope for the best.
We've already done – well, I don't know what plan for the worst is other than what we're doing now, but what's the hope for the best? What is the best case? I don't think the best case scenario is like a realistic best case scenario.
We're not going to have aliens deliver a cure tomorrow. It's
right.
So I think the best case scenario is that we start to see a tapering off of new cases, that we have a strong, maybe not enforcement, but kind of social pressure for the social distancing for a few more weeks to maybe a month, and it blows over into we're not going to see it stop. Yeah. But if we can drop the rate of transmission down to much lower numbers, I think we can go back to a new normal.
Right.
I don't see that happening in less than a month, though. even in the
maybe
best
the
case
testing
scenario.
Maybe the testing situation can be gotten under control too, where tests can become more available and
there are a lot of incremental steps to be done there. I know that there are some folks working towards an at-home test. I don't know if it'll be as simple and ubiquitous as, you know, home pregnancy tests or something of the like, but if test equipment could be made reliably and in quantities like that, then I think that would take a lot of the panic and uncertainty out of the equation.
Yeah. It would definitely, dude, if there was like a $200 test that people can, I bet a lot of healthy people would just buy it. Maybe like I said before, the rule is you get a discount on your test if you report your results and your data.
And I guess my question then becomes, what do you do with that information? So if you've confirmed that you are not infected, well, you still have to think about protecting yourself from becoming infected in all the same ways you did before.
I think for a lot of people, it's just peace of mind. Yeah. I think a lot of people are trying to go. I know a lot of people are trying to go to hospitals to get the test. I have a friend who works at a hospital in Connecticut. He says lots of people are coming in. They demand the test. The people who get the test, they're all negative right now at that particular hospital. It's like negative, negative, negative. So
my policy is that I am not going to get sick. And if I'm not sick, I don't have to worry about whether it's coronavirus or something else.
Yeah.
And you should all do the same.
All right. No, I think that best case scenario is certainly possible. It's not totally far fetched, and it might end up being what happened in a few weeks' time. We've got this thing under control. In fact, that's probably the most likely scenario at this point.
But well, so which is more depressing for you right now? Making predictions on Metaculus for the presidential elections or for COVID-19?
I was trying to end on a positive note, and then you extended the show to ask what's more depressing for you.
Let me rephrase that. Which of those two do you find more uplifting? That I just flipped it on its head.
Okay, good.
Because for those of you listening who are interested, there are a lot of predictions around confirmed case rates and growth rates on there right now. So if that's your bag, go check that out.
Yeah, a lot of things are moving right now. And what was the other thing you mentioned? There was that, and there was the.
Comparing that to the presidential politics ongoing.
Oh, I have not seen that. So I will we'll cover that in the future. That's going to be a fascinating race. I mean, now that it looks like it's going to be Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, that's.
I will throw out. I think there was a question on there about what the likelihood that coronavirus will affect. The candidates.
Don't even.
I think meaning directly that one of the presidential candidates will be incapacitated such that they are no longer a presidential candidate by it. And I think they put that at the community is putting that at pretty much a non factor.
Oh, they think it's very unlikely. Yeah. Interesting.
The odds of Trump or Biden contracting coronavirus pretty low.
But what's the odds of them contracting anything? Well, at that age, like, I mean, it can't be 0%. Well, they would try to hide it as much as they can, but at some point you can't. I mean, it's certainly not 0%. It could be like 0.5%, 1%. I don't know. there's a non-0% about it. Yeah, we have a lot of stuff to talk about in politics. We have cryptocurrency hard down today over the last couple of weeks. It could be back up by the time this goes goes live. So who knows? Could be real opportunities to make a lot of money, real opportunities to lose a lot of money.
I haven't been following that in the crypto world, but I can tell you with certainty that crypto isn't the only thing that's been hard down in the last few days.
Yep.
They're moving with the market, not against it there.
Yeah. All right. So I think we've covered this enough. We've gone on for an hour. Hopefully, I think people have gotten some... good information, even if I ramble a little bit on Bayesian networks, but maybe some people might want to look that up. But hope, I don't know. I think we did a better job than reading Twitter. You spent a better hour than reading Twitter. You might have a few things to look through.
It's a low bar, but we try to deliver it every week. Be better than Twitter.
No, I think we have met that bar every single week, without a doubt. Okay. I mean, if anything, we'll take the best things from Twitter. But no, I think this works. All right. Let me know if you have any specific questions about what's going on, and let me know if there's... if you have any specific recommendations out there, localmaxradio.com @gmail.com, if you want to weigh in, if anything's happening in your life. I think that's all I got. Is that all you got?
One, wash your damn hands, people. And two, I look forward to hearing a report next week on the best food available in takeout and delivery in your neighborhood.
All right. Sounds good. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account at Max Sklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.